So I've always been very reluctant to give this talk, and probably I could have given this talk at any time over the last 2 years. But I always had something more physical or more easy to talk about, and so I usually talked about that instead. But this, at last, it seems to be a good forum for this kind of talk, this ADS-CFT month of the Math and Strings workshop. And so I'm happy to be here talking about exceptional collections for the first time. Or at least in this kind of detail. So I beg you all to be very patient, because I'm not actually going to define exceptional collection for about half an hour. And instead, I want to start with a rather long-winded motivation. So a lot of the sort of background material for this talk from a physics point of view you can find in this very nice review by Aspinwall, which I recommend. It's on HepTH. And the actual details about what I'm going to talk about today come from two papers I wrote, mostly. One, I guess, a year and a half ago, and one with Robert Karp, who's at Rutgers, a postdoc at Rutgers, I wrote very recently. So if you want more details, it's all here. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to try and make it as accessible as I can, probably at the price of being less than accurate occasionally. What I want to start with, instead of with a definition of what is an exceptional collection, I want to start with a different kind of question, which is slightly more physical. Is it, what is the low energy gauge theory on a stack of D3, on a stack of D brains? Probing or at a Calabi-Yau singularity. So this is the question I would like to answer today in some large sense of generality. And why is this question important? Well, I can think of three reasons. Maybe you guys can think of some more. One is in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence. For each of these constructions, I should get some kind of generalized ADS-CFT construction, which might eventually be useful in understanding strongly coupled gauge theories, et cetera, et cetera. Another reason this might be interesting to string theorists is, say, maybe a holographic understanding of flux vacua. There are all these nice flux vacua recently where most, if not all, of the moduli of the string theory are stabilized, and these kinds of constructions might give you some holographic understanding for what's going on in these supergravity descriptions. And the last question for the more old-fashioned of us is, what is a D-brain anyway? And I think maybe going through this process, we get a slightly deeper appreciation for what a D-brain actually is. And to be a little bit more concrete, I'm not really interested in this full general problem. I want to restrict to type 2B string theory in 10 dimensions, and in particular on this following background, where I take Minkowski space cross my Calabi-Yau. So X is some Calabi-Yau manifold with a singularity. So X is a singular, usually non-compact, although you can imagine, I guess, a situation where some compact Calabi-Yau locally looks like this X Calabi-Yau threefold, so three complex dimensional. Okay. So in this context, we have odd dimensional brains. We have D3, we have D5, and we have D7 brains. In type 2A, there'd be even dimensional brains. And I want a supersymmetric setup. I want to preserve some kind of supersymmetry. Always today, there'll be at least n equals 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So in that context, I need to make sure these guys wrap holomorphic cycles. So what does that mean? Well, okay. So they're going to span the Minkowski space directions, and that's the gauge theory directions. And then in the X, they're going to wrap holomorphic cycles. So D3 brains look like points, D5 brains wrap complex curves, and these D7 brains wrap complex surfaces.
Did you conclude that the brain filled the Nikol filter?
Maybe not. There's a paper yesterday by Strominger where he uses type 2A and a slightly different setup and argues for some gauge theory where the D brains aren't spanning this R3 comma 1. But I guess I'm sort of trapped in this ADS-CFT land, and so this is what I think about, the way I think about it. But yeah, just do some T-dualities and get rid of the R3 comma 1 directions. Okay, so that's the setup. And a lot is known about the answer to this question already. So what is known? So let me draw the following Venn diagram. So I want to draw a set of orbifolds. So this is the case where I'm taking some discrete group, discrete quotient of a complex, three complex dimensional space, and that's clearly an example of this, if this discrete subgroup satisfies some certain special properties. Another nice example are the toric examples. There are a lot of toric non-compact Clavier manifolds with these kinds of singularities. Where they overlap, we have these abelian orbifolds. And another set that I'll be interested in today are these Delpezzos, which have, I guess, shown up in one place or another. Can people see up here under the shade? Is that okay? Okay. So these are Delpezzos. So where all three of these overlap, there's, I think, just actually one example. It's this so-called P2, which gives rise to this C3 mod Z3 orbifold. So what I mean here is that when I mean a Delpezzo, what I really mean is I mean this sort of a Clabiao where the Delpezzo surface shrinks to zero size, and this P2 is an example of a Delpezzo surface. And when that shrinks to zero size, there's a point in the Kähler moduli space where it looks like this orbifold.
So it's a vibration over a Delpezzo?
The total space of the canonical line bundle over the Delpezzo.
There are a few other points which coincide at least some special values of the moduli space for the Delpezzo 8 and for the Delpezzo 6.
That's true, yes. That's true. So this diagram is a little bit more complicated than I've drawn. But there's some other examples in here. There's a P1 cross P1. There are these three Delpezzos, which are toric. So I'll call B1, B2, and B3, corresponding to P2 blown up at 1, 2, or 3 points. And there are a bunch of other guys up here, Bn for 3 less than or equal to n, less than or equal to 8, and some integer. Okay, so that's my Venn diagram, and basically everything in here is pretty well understood. I think it's fair to say. So let me tell you a little bit about the history of this, for those who aren't familiar. First came, I guess, the orbifolds. So you knew from the original, say, ADS-CFT correspondence, perhaps, that if you just put these D3 brains in flat space, you would get this nice n equals 4 SUN super Yang-Mills theory. And then if you want to consider these orbifolds, so here I want to take gamma to be some discrete subgroup of SU3, so that the orbifold preserves this n equals 1 supersymmetry. If I take this, then I can use some representation theory to understand what the gauge theory is on this orbifold. And this was done, I guess, originally by people like Greg Moore, sitting here in the audience, and Douglas, and might mention Morrison and Plesser, too, and some mathematicians have also been interested in this problem for other reasons, like the McKay correspondence, people like Sardo and Fieri. So this was all done, I guess, even before, some of it before ADS-CFT. Okay. So the second thing I guess people sort of understood here was the toric case. So what do I mean by toric? I mean that this non-compact Calabi-Yau has some 3U1 isometries. So X you can kind of understand as some local quotient by a torus. So the C star to the Q minus 3 is some torus. So this.
What's up, delta?
So you when you do this quotient, you usually have to wind up subtracting some certain points. So for example, for P2, you have to subtract the origin in order for this to be well defined. So in this case where X is toric, there were a lot of methods developed, I guess, starting with, say, Morrison and Plesser, and then Ami Hanani here and his many collaborators really developed this subject. There's something called the inverse algorithm, which has been mentioned in some of the seminars here already. And the basic idea here is that you start with, say, at least the way I understand it, you start with, say, C3 mod Zn cross Zn, and you start partially resolving it. And at the end of the day, you can usually, for n sufficiently large, you can get any kind of toric singularity from this process. But unfortunately, for n greater than 4, this process was very slow. So in principle, you could always work out the gauge theory, but in practice, it was rather slow for anything too complicated. So more recently, there have been a lot of talks here at the workshop about dimer methods. By David, by Ami Hanani, by Sergio Benvenuti, by Brian Wecht yesterday. And this promises to be much faster, but I think it's still fair to say. We don't really understand what's going on. So, I mean, it's more, I guess, in the sense of an observation that these kinds of methods work for deriving the gauge theory rather than a proof. So, that's for this and this. So those are kind of understood, more or less. And then the exceptional collections. So finally, I get to introduce exceptional collections in some context. So the third method here.
So the dimer methods are all within the toric context?
As yet, they are. And I think they'll probably remain that way, although Ami and I disagree on this. Okay, so third comes exceptional collections. And I'd like to make a claim here, which I think may be a little optimistic. I want to claim that these exceptional collection methods will work for any case where the singularity of the of this compact Calabi-Yau can be partially resolved, so not even completely resolved, but partially resolved by blowing up a possibly singular. Probably the singularities can't be too bad here, but you should allow some singularities. Possibly singular compact complex surface. And so that's what I want to claim. So that, for example, will take care of all the Delpezzos, because all of these Delpezzos, what they are is there's some Calabi-Yau singularity where a Delpezzo surface is shrinking to zero size. So if you blow that singularity back, you blow that Delpezzo surface back up, you've totally resolved the space. And in fact, in that case, everything is smooth, and you don't have to worry about these singular bits.
What do you mean by partially?
What do I mean by partially? So let me answer that by describing what happens in the toric case. So I know that it seems, or at least it seems that in the toric case, these exceptional collections work too, and that's the subject of this paper. Again, it's a little bit more of the sense of an observation as yet. There are a lot of things that remain to be proved, but so I know that a lot of people have been drawing these so-called toric diagrams for these X's, these clavios. So let me draw a few of them. So this, for example, is the toric diagram written down for C3. So the idea here is there's actually supposed to be some additional point, and this is essentially the real part of the toric manifold, I guess, one way of thinking about it. I don't know. So this is a slice through this three-dimensional cone. This is the conifold. And there's some other guys that you can imagine drawing, lots of things you can imagine drawing. So here I'll draw the toric diagram for C3 mod Z5. So in the cases where there are internal points in these toric diagrams, that corresponds to there being some kind of force cycle that you can blow up. But often, if there's more than one point, if you just blow up one of those force cycles, you haven't completely resolved the singularity. So in this case, C3 mod Z5, you know, you could just pick, my claim here is basically that you just need to pick out one point, blow this guy up. It will correspond to some surface which is not even smooth, and the result is not smooth. The total clavio is still not smooth, but still, this exceptional collection method works.
So, you have an understanding of what partially resolved means in the non-toric context? Because that only really sort of covers the toric cases.
Right. No, I don't have any examples in the non-toric context. But I would hope it would work. I don't know. And so this almost concludes my introduction. So this is why I think exceptional collections are quite important. Essentially, they allow you to treat almost all of these examples. And these examples which you're not allowed to treat, it turns out that, you know, you can always orbifold them, and if you orbifold them enough times, you'll typically introduce some force cycles that you can blow up. So even if you can't address the unorbifolded case, you wind up being able to address the orbifolded case, and then maybe you can work backwards. And in fact, there's some papers about this. I know that Aaron Bergman wrote a paper about trying to work backward in this context.
So can you make an estimate
I think as long as your the singularities associated with this compact surface you're blowing up are no more than orbifold, it's probably okay. I don't have much intuition, but I'd like to make this claim in case it's true. I mean, it's certainly true in this toric case, and it also works for all the Dalpezzos. And, you know, there are lots of points that sit outside this nice Venn diagram here, and let me just write one of them down. So just to show you sort of the scope of this problem. So I picked this guy out of a paper by Kolar and Thompson. So this polynomial in four complex variables cuts out a cone in C4. And in fact, you can put a Calabi-Yau metric on it. Due to a theorem by Tian and Yao. But I have no idea what the gauge theory is. It's not going to be a toric example, certainly not an orbifold. It's not a Dalpezzo. But you might hope that through looking at the four cycle, or four cycles associated to this guy, you could write down some exceptional collection and at the end of the day work out a gauge theory. I'm currently not strong enough to be able to do that, but I think it's in the realm of possibility. Okay, so that.
Such examples are there in the literature?
Yeah, essentially all you need to do is, I mean, so this is the process for, that you would use to construct such a thing, right, is you, basically what you do is you find some weighted homogeneous polynomial such that the sum of the weights is greater than the degree. So the weights of this polynomial here are 5, 14, 17, 21, and the total degree here is 56, and the sum here I think is 57. So the sum of the weights minus the degree is greater than zero. That means it's Calabi-Yau, and the reason that's in this paper by Kolar and Thompson is they prove essentially that it's a quasi-regular. The associated Sasaki-Einstein manifold is quasi-regular. And so there's a fairly nice four manifold associated with it, a complex surface that you can blow up. No, they don't.
Seven times 5 plus 21 is 56.
Yeah. Maybe one of them is wrong. I did this addition in myself, so possibly I. They just give me these, and I wrote this to my computer.
What was the 57?
The number.
57.
5 plus 14 plus 17 plus 21 is 57, and then 57. Minus 56 is greater than or equal to zero, so it's a Calabi-Yau. And the reason it's in this paper by Kolar and Thompson is that they prove that there's an associated variety in weighted projective space which has a Kähler-Einstein metric up to some orbifold singularities, so that the associated Sasaki-Einstein manifold is quasi-regular. And so the moral here is there's a nice complex surface you can blow up. And so presumably there's also a nice exceptional collection you could write down on this example, but I don't know what it is.
Is it clear what are quadratic relations for this surface, in addition to this?
Quadratic relations? No, this, I mean, I just define it this way. This is my surface.
No more.
Yeah, I mean, in general, you can cut out your surface in more complicated ways, and there are all sorts of examples that are Calabi-Yau for which we have no idea what the gauge theory is.
Why do you say that if there is a quadrilateral on a Calabi-Yau, then there is a cosine for the complex cosine?
Well, I thought that was.
Well, the quadrilateral.
That was proven. There's P1 cross P1. Oh, what you say? Oh, I see. I mean, I'm working the other way. I know that there's a Kähler-Einstein metric associated. There's the complex surface that has a Kähler-Einstein metric that's associated to this polynomial treated as a variety in weighted projective space. And so I can construct a circle bundle over that, which is quasi-regular, and I can construct the cone over that, which is Calabi-Yau. I probably shouldn't have given this example. It's just distracting. But it's fun, so I gave it anyway. At this point, I need to go into the technical details. And so I've wasted 20 minutes. I've spent 20 minutes so far. And now the talk gets a little harder. So now I need to somehow explain how these exceptional collections come up. And it's rather a long story, unfortunately. I mean, morally, what's happening is pretty clear, right? So for each stack of D-brains, there's some UN gauge theory. And then, so D-brains are boundaries, boundary conditions for open strings. So wherever these D-brains intersect, there's some massless open string. And you expect that for each massless open string, you'd have some kind of bifundamental matter for these between, say, the transforms under this bifundamental representation of two of these UN gauge groups. But this really isn't going to cut it, because I need some way of rigorously computing what all these intersections are and what the masses are, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why this story gets so involved. So let me be more precise. And the first part of being more precise, I have to give you a more precise definition of D-brains. So there's this statement, or it's this usual sentence that you find in papers, that Kontsevich conjectured and Douglas and collaborators argued that these holomorphically wrapped D-brains are objects in the derived category of coherent sheaves. So at the end of the day, I want to argue that these D-brains are objects in some derived category of coherent sheaves on my clavier. So how do I get there? Well, not very rigorously, but we'll do our best. So as a first pass, I want to argue that these D-brains are vector bundles. Now that seems quite reasonable, because we have these objects which are wrapping submanifolds in some Clavijau X. And well, they're supposedly associated with some gauge theory, so there's some gauge field living on the D-brains. And it seems quite reasonable that if you treat each submanifold separately, you can write some vector bundle that lives on each of them, on each of these submanifolds. But that's not quite going to cut it. And the reason it doesn't quite cut it is that we don't want to have a definition where we have to sort of look at each submanifold separately. You want to have to look at the whole thing altogether. And while the standard definition of vector bundles is you move around on your space, however you define it, say we define it as M, the rank of that vector bundle shouldn't change. Whereas for these D-brain configurations, I mean, maybe you have some D4 brain sitting on some submanifold, and then there's some D0 brain, which is a point sitting inside it. And as you're moving around, right, the rank's going to jump from 1, where you're sitting on the D4 brain, to 2, where you sit on both the D4 and the D0. And the way to handle this is to consider a slightly more general object, and you want to promote these. This is second pass. You promote these D-brains to sheaves. So now you can think about, well, maybe say you have some, sheaf of holomorphic functions on your space X. That's some line bundle. That's fine as a vector bundle, but you also want to be able to think of some sheaf of holomorphic functions sitting on some submanifold sitting inside X. And although that's a vector bundle on D, it's not a vector bundle on X. And maybe you also want to think of things that are defined just at a point, say skyscraper sheaves, for say D0 brains. And there again, maybe you have some trivial vector bundle located at a point, but in general, what you have is a sheaf. You have this skyscraper sheaf.
So at which point did these vector bundles become holomorphic?
They became holomorphic at the very beginning, because I'm insisting that I have supersymmetry and I want these D-brains to be wrapping holomorphic cycles, and I'm really interested in topological quantities, so I don't need too much information beyond the fact that these things are holomorphic. This is a good question, but this is...
Yeah, the D-brain is more like
right. But hopefully I'm going to keep enough information that I can tell you what the gauge theory is. So I'm treating, just by treating these D-brains as holomorphic, I'm going to keep enough information.
How much do you know these?
Can you think about an open string field theory? I mean, he's sort of keeping low energy, the zero nodes, throwing away all the higher nodes, and also restricting to supersymmetric configurations. Whereas a D-brain, of course, can wobble and do all sorts of things that are not supersymmetric. Mm-hmm. As he says, it's fine. We have to calculate the things. It's a lot simpler than a constraint system.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, but this D brains as sheaves is apparently not going to cut it either, because in addition to brains in this context, I need some notion of anti-brains. And maybe back here when I was thinking of D brains as vector bundles, it was okay, because I can sort of take the inverse of a vector bundle and consider the inverse as maybe some anti-brain. Here, mathematicians will tell you that taking the inverse of a sheaf is not so nice, and a much better way of doing this, as suggested by Douglas and Kontsevich and many others, is to make a third pass here and say that D brains are not just sheaves, but D brains are complexes of sheaves. And then you can associate changing a brain to an anti-brain by shifting the complex by one position. So let me show you what I mean. So we have a map delta, which maps, say, a sheaf E into a complex. And we can imagine the anti-brain for E being the complex shifted one unit to the left to be this guy. And this kind of makes sense, because when you consider the charges of these complexes, what you're doing is you're taking an alternating sum of all of these entries. So if I shift one place to the left, I invert the charge of the D brain. So D brains are complexes of sheaves. And you're really not quite done here, but for the purposes of this talk, we're essentially done. I mean, the next step is essentially too difficult for me to do in the context of the seminar. But you have to sort of carefully worry about which of these complexes are isomorphic. And at the end of the day, what you find after working out all the equivalence relations between these complexes is you find this derived category of coherent sheaves, whose objects are these complexes up to some complicated equivalence relations, which I'm not telling you. Okay, so we're more precise now about D brains, and now I have to be more precise about the open strings.
So I have a question. I'm
yeah.
Supposing I have
probably not
a complex,
answer.
But I think heuristically, in terms of the D brain, I have some brain wrapping, some holomorphic cycle. One part of it is the Lattice, and then another anti-brain wrapping, another holomorphic cycle, which is in the same homology class. Okay, and it's far away within the same homology class. Is this a non-zero object in the derived category? I haven't said it very precisely yet. I think it could be said.
I guess I see your concern, yeah, and I...
My impression is that it is a non-zero object.
It is a non-zero.
In the derived category. Whereas, you know, physically, we know that these things are going to wander around and find each other.
Right.
And so this is a concern I have, that when you formulate this topological theory of D brains,
you're missing this physical effect.
The physical processes. And this is part of the price you pay for not picking the rings.
Was it visible symmetric or?
But you could formulate it in this. I think what I said could be formulated in this sheaf.
When you do sample dualities, you encounter such cases.
You encounter what?
You encounter similar cases. You can think of the dual gauge group will have number of colors n, f minus and c. So you can separate those two contributions and think of the minus and c,
yeah,
as the undivergence.
Okay.
And the nf, typically nf has to be greater than c in order to make sense.
But you would agree that brains and anti-brains will eventually finally settle down.
And the category of intimate, I mean, if you take the one state of these two brains,
yeah,
which would be this cone construction in the category, then that has a mapping to the zero object, but I think if you don't do the construction, then it's not a zero object.
Okay, so you say that if there's another object, which...
I'm saying there would be some open string between these two planes, which would be a morphism in the category, and we can, using this...
But this open string is extremely massive, because this brain and empty brain are far separate.
But that category doesn't know that. I mean, then you would need the stability conditions to know if the bound state actually forms or not, and if they're far away, then it wouldn't form. But
So the answer is, do you think the answer is that they actually would be different non-zero objects in the direction?
It depends what you mean by the sum of these two things. If by sum you mean the bound state, then it would be isomorphic to the zero object. But if by sum you just mean that they are there, but you don't turn on the morphism, then it's non-zero at that point.
Okay.
Yeah, how about this triangle sort of possible bound state that could form, and then whether they form or not depends on additional information that is not in the category. This is a bit.
Oh, I see. So you're suggesting that the stable objects in the derived category might be
right.
Well, the correct physical.
Now, well, of course, it is
more related
than just what is encoded in the derived category. So if you want to know if the deep brain is annihilated, then there's something outside of the.
Let me go on. Maybe things will become a little clearer when I talk about the open strings. But this is certainly a good question. So here I think I'm even going to be probably less rigorous. And since I don't really have time to develop linear sigma models with target space Clavieux, I'm just essentially going to guess. I'm going to say that I'm interested in massless degrees of freedom, so that to me means topological. And so if I have, say, two holomorphic vector bundles, V and W, I'm going to guess that the open string states fall in some kind of cohomology classes. Or I hope this notation is okay. And since I'm on a Clavieux with dimension 3, Q is 0, 1, 2, or 3. So these are the candidate open string states. And I claim that you can do a more careful analysis using this sigma model and come up with the same result. Of course, there's a problem, right? Because this object here is not so well defined for sheaves. So instead, what mathematicians typically do is they introduce this X to notation, where if I have sheaves E and F, there's this object instead, and in the special case where I can associate vector bundle V to sheaf E and vector bundle W to sheaf F, this is equal to this guy. So, I mean, if there's some relation between E and V and F and W. Okay, but we're still not done because, remember, we didn't stop at sheaves. We stopped at objects in this drive category. So again, if I have x to k between E and F, then this has to map to some even more complicated object in this drive category. These are the maps between the objects in the drive category. So I have some derived version of homomorphisms. And I can imagine converting in a special case again where these are very simple. I can promote these to complexes, which are non-zero everywhere except one place. I have this result. Okay. And these are these considered as maps between these objects in the drive category, these are our candidate open strings.
So by calm, those are morphisms in this category?
I think so, yeah.
And some are PMQ?
No summation here. This is just the fact that as I shift P, I have to shift P up here too.
What is P?
P is how many places I shifted E when I made it a complex. So like here, delta E of 1, that means I shifted E 1 to the left. I mean, in general, these guys are not just complexes which are non-zero at one place. They're complicated complexes which are non-zero in lots of places, and this object is more complicated.
So you argued that taking, if you shift 1 to the left, you go from brain to anti-brain.
Right.
What happens if you shift 3 to the left?
That is also an anti-brain.
Is there a difference between those two anti-brains?
There apparently is, and it's a subtle difference which I don't completely understand.
So if E is a complicated object.
Sorry, E and F here are always sheaves. So if, in general, right, I might have just some complexes A and B, and I have to calculate this guy. And I haven't told you how to do that in general, but I guess there's some kind of spectral sequence which would let you do it.
The formula
about
E and F are concentrated in some degree.
Delta E is concentrated in some degree, and delta F is concentrated in some degree. So delta maps a sheaf to a complex.
So if there is no sign, it doesn't depend on E or Q. There is no sign, it depends on P and Q.
That's right. Because your open strings depend whether you're dealing with brains or anti-brains. And if you shift by one, the string that used to be a massless string might become tachyonic, as we'll see in a moment.
What determines P and Q?
This is just a formula. You're free to choose P and Q however you like. Okay.
So the right hand side really doesn't depend on E or Q.
Not really.
Okay.
Or it does in this way. I mean, I'm running out of time. This is too bad. I have to at least be able to define an exceptional collection. So there's a mass formula for these open strings, which looks like this. So it's equivalent to this the sort of BPS relation that, for example, Brian Wecht wrote down in his talk the other day for these D equals 4 superconformal field theories. But this is now for this sigma model instead. So the masses, so given some non-zero Hom here, the mass of that string is this guy, where I haven't told you what these Xs are. So these Xs are phases of some charge of the D-brains. And in the simple case where these complexes are non-zero, at just one place, for example, I have delta E shifted n places to the left. This is e to the pi n c of e. So the charge, as I was claiming earlier, whether it's a brain or an anti-brain, just depends whether n is even or odd. And there's formulas for these central charges, which are unfortunately a whole story in and of themselves. They depend on your position in the Kähler moduli space of this Calabi-Yau. They depend on B and J. They also depend on the Chern classes of these sheaves, and they depend on the Todd class of this Calabi-Yau. And in fact, they depend on other stuff too. So this formula is actually only true at some point called large volume in Kähler moduli space. And in general, there's this whole story involving mirror symmetry and the Picard-Fuchs equations, which allow you to calculate this. But we're going to shortcut all of this. So
there's an exact formula. Yeah.
Yes. Right. So in principle, that's exactly right. You just compute the periods of these three forms in the mirror, and you get this exactly. But I don't want to develop any of that. I'm going to take a shortcut.
Can you say something about how this mass formula is derived? What is the meaning of each?
my impression is that this is essentially like an R charge. We're dealing with BPS states, or states which maximize some inequality between the charge and the mass. So we saturate this inequality, and then there's this coefficient, which instead of being 3/2 as it was in D equals 4 superconformal field theories, happens to be 1/2. I don't want to say more.
But you cannot translate this to the mass for dimensions, right? Or the length of the string. It's not the length of the string.
It's, no, not really. No. So I wouldn't.
You said it should be some volume.
I said there should be some volume.
You said it's an R charge.
In the same sense,
it is a volume. Look, expand at large J. It's like the integral of JQ.
Good. Thanks.
If you just take the 0.1 part out of the term.
Excuse me, I'm using string
A. Am I using?
String theory code 1.
So I'm working in the string length or string coupling.
Are you omitting 1 over a prime?
Yeah.
So is that kind of some spectral flow or on the world sheet?
The spectral flow of the world sheet.
Angled grain, so we have some spectral flow of opposite on the
world sheet. That's where the K comes from. The K comes from the spectral flow.
Okay. Did I define K? K is this.
And what is K in the spectral flow?
I don't remember exactly. As I recall, as he said, this is m squared equals 1/2 the R charge for chiral primary. And Michael had some argument that going to the kth step and in some sequence was spectrally flowing in a U1. The U1R charge, he bosonized with the U1R charge. And then he argued that shifting K steps in this Hom here was the same as shifting the U1 boson by K. That's how we got this K.
So the left hand side is M squared. I think the volume will be mass of the solid itself.
This is m squared. This is the mass.
If you wrap the D-brand for the whole Calabian, the mass will be.
D-brand or open string?
This is open strings joining.
Okay, yeah, that's one point.
We also have an explanation for the minus one.
That was this. Oh. All right, let me go on. So I wanted to shortcut this whole calculation of CA, and I just want to quote some result by Aspinwall, which you can find in 0407123, which claims essentially that at the point in this Kähler moduli space that we're interested in, all of these CA are the same. And he proved this for the Del Pezzos, but in the more general case, you still need a proof.
It should be general for any Calabi-Yau's we like. But for any cubes?
This is for a special point in the Kähler moduli space where this 4-cycle that we're blowing up shrinks to zero size. This was
but
proved.
This is truly for some special case.
This is true for the Del Pezzos. What I believe happens is that you look at the periods. And they're all real numbers, so.
For which sheet, something like that, just a singly wrapped Del Pezzo or something.
So you have some collection of periods for these ZV, yeah. And there's a basis, so I don't know, there are however many, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. And they're all real numbers at some locus in the moduli space. So there's no way of getting phases when you sum them up. So you can see this explicitly, for example, in P2.
So then the size are just e to the i pi n, and it doesn't matter what the z's are, because they don't have any phases.
Right.
So the dependence on the sheet is
the dependence on this angle drops out. And this becomes the mass formula. So now, at this, these special points in Kähler moduli space, which are exactly the points that I'm interested in putting my D3 brains at, I can make some arguments about what the spectrum should look like. And this is essentially the critical argument of the talk. So you can consider an open string from one D brain to itself. So clearly, if k equals 0, this corresponds to some tachyon, and mass squared would be minus 1. If k equals 1, this is a massless scalar. And if k is greater than or equal to 2, then we forget about it, because it's massive, and it just gets integrated out of the low-energy theory. OK, so what do we do with this tachyon? Well, we know that in flat space, if we have D brains and they're supersymmetric, there's some GSO projection which gets rid of this tachyon. So leaving the topological sector for a moment, we can imagine some tower of string states that sits above k equals 0 for this tachyonic mode. And the first excited state here is some massless vector. And this is exactly what we expect for these D brains. You expect some set of massless vectors, which gives you the gauge theory living on that D brain. Isn't it always a vector?
Well, then you have supersymmetries, so
there's a partner, certainly. There's a Gaugino. These things fall in n equals 1 multiplets.
Can be a Kähler multiplet.
I thought the oscillators all have the Lorentz indices in them, so if you...
So you associate the k with some kind of vector index?
The k equals 0 gets promoted to this massless vector.
Somehow you're saying that k equals 0 is a scalar and k equals 1 is a vector, and I guess you would say that...
No, I'm not saying k equals 1 is a vector. I'm saying that the lowest states in this topological sector are all scalars. I'm saying the k equals 1 guy would be a massless scalar. I'm saying the k equals 0 guy would be a tachyon. But I'm saying that from our understanding of D brains in flat space, there's a GSO projection which gets rid of that. And then the first state in that excited tower is a massless vector. So there's a gauge theory living on the low energy theory of that D brain.
This is a classification of ground states of the string. You have one left.
Right. So this is the first part of the argument. So we're looking for a set of objects in this derived category where these k equals 0 states are present, so we get these massless vectors. And then the second part of this argument, if we consider an open string from one D brain to another...
Sorry, it's a good question, but shouldn't you have a massless vector even in this case, rather than a massless scalar?
So the ground state doesn't have Lorentz index, that's what you're saying.
The ground state doesn't have Lorentz indices.
So for k equals 0 sector, the ground state is tachyon, so it's a scalar, but it's projected out, and the next level, the next excited state is a vector.
Right.
Is massless.
Right. And then there are other towers associated with these k's, but this tower I can forget because it's all going to be massive, and this tower might be there or might not. I don't care.
So if we just had a D brain in flat space, what would be the k equals 1?
So this would be, say you had n equals 2 supersymmetry, you could have a bunch of, you could have a n equals 2 multiplet, vector multiplet. So that would come with the massless vectors from this guy and the...
When you say massless scalar, these states form supermultiplets.
Yes, yes. Right.
It could be, you really mean a scalar multiplet or
a... Absolutely.
It's one or the other.
Absolutely.
Is there some reason that the multiplets don't mix between the tower from 0 and the tower from 1, and that the multiplets are combinations from various k's? Because it seems like you're assuming
Right, so if I had n equals 2 supersymmetry, then the massless vector from the tachyon guy, tower would mix with the massless vector from this guy, and you get an n equals 2 multiplet, vector multiplet.
So the point which distinguishes a chiral multiplet from a vector multiplet is whether the string depends on the same grain or not?
No, it. I mean, it depends on these k's. That's what I want to say. So this is for an open string from one D-brain to itself, and the second part of this argument depends on looking at the open strings from one D-brain to another. Okay. So k equals 1 here is fine. So this is, again, some massless scalar. K greater than 2, we can again forget. And now for k equals 0, I have to dance. I don't have a completely good argument for this, but it's pretty clear what has to happen. So let's assume we had a k equals 0 state. So either there's a GSO projection which gets rid of it, or there isn't. If there isn't, then we're in trouble. Okay. So let's assume there is a GSO projection which gets rid of this k equals 0 state. All right, so the next state up in that tower, I was saying, was going to be some massless vector. But now that massless vector is transforming not in an adjoint representation of some gauge group, it's transforming in some bifundamental representation of these two UNs. And so I challenge you to write down an action for such a guy. And basically, you can't do it. If you have a massless vector, it should transform in the adjoint of some gauge group. Well, this, and that gauge group should be some product of simple Lie groups. But this bifundamental representation, although it may be the adjoint of some Lie group, certainly not a semi-simple Lie group. You can't express that Lie group as a product of a simple Lie groups. So you cannot have k equals 0. Cannot have k equals 0.
Well, there is some kind of a stringy explanation for why this is projected out. So this is, does not exist.
Well, the point is that when I write down my D brains, I want to write down a set of D brains which doesn't have this problem. And if it doesn't have this problem, then I can trust the gauge theory I get. I don't have to flow to get rid of the condensed tachyon or deal with this very peculiar bifundamental.
Presumably, the answer is it just gets a mass if you separate the
brains. If you have a tachyon, then usually it implies there's some bound state you have to form between the D brains. So you have to re-diagonalize your basis. That's the way I would think of it. But
well, not if it's projected out.
Not if it's projected out.
And then you can ask what happens to the, what was the vector, and that one's gotten massive.
What I suspect is that there is no GSO projection, and the reason there can't be is because there's this weird state that you'd find higher up, which is even stranger.
So does it, my question, but does it even matter that the brains are separated in this case? What if the brains were all stacked at the same point, so that you know, it would cost you in the old way of thinking to stretch the string. This would still be the case for your arguments, right?
Yeah, I'm sort of basically thinking fairly topologically here, so I'm not really thinking of these D brains as being separated by any distance. Be some additional data, which I'm not sure is encoded. Well, I guess it's sort of encoded. I'm not sure it's really encoded here.
The position of the brain should be encoded.
All right. So where am I? So I just got through this argument, and now I'm finally ready to sort of motivate exceptional collections. So what I'm looking for now is I'm looking for some collections of objects in this derived category such that, you know, these k equals 0 states from a brain to itself will be there, so I get these massless vectors. And I'm looking also for some set of D brains which have no k equals 0 states from one brain to another. They only have these sort of k equals 1 states. And this essentially is the answer to that question that I posed at the beginning. What is the gauge theory for low energy gauge theory of a set of D brains probing this Clavius singularity? And probably most of you look at this and say, gosh, he's reformulated it in a way it's even harder for me to figure out what the answer is. And I mean, 2 years ago, I would have felt the same way. But let me show you why. That's not true. And since I'm really sort of running out of time, maybe I'll just state this theorem, and then maybe we can break for lunch, and I can talk later at some other point, or for those who are interested or not. So the theorem, which I guess I sort of, maybe I'll claim responsibility for this theorem. So given a Calabi-Yau X, which is total space of a canonical bundle over some del pezzo, del pezzo B, there exists a strongly strongly exceptional collection of sheaves, E1, E2, up to EN. And in fact, there's another condition here which I need. I have to generate something called a strong helix. Which lifts, in a fairly non-trivial way, to these fractional brains. So these objects with these nice properties between the X, these nice properties of these homomorphisms, I'll call fractional brains. If I have some set of objects in the derived category which have these nice properties about for the open strings, I'll call those fractional brains. So if I have a strongly exceptional collection of sheaves, which generates the strong helix, it will lift in a fairly non-trivial way, which I can describe in probably about half an hour, to these fractional brains on X. And so that works for del pezzos. And the conjecture I'd like to make is that it would work also for what I was saying at the beginning, any singular Calabi-Yau, which can be partially resolved by blowing up a partially or possibly singular complex surface.
Could you, before you finish, I know we're all restless, but maybe you should at least define an exceptional collection.
Good, thanks.
A little wonderful, I think, which would be the fractional brain, since there's no orbifold.
Since there's no orbifold.
I don't know what a fractional brain is.
By fractional brain, I mean a set of objects in this drive category such that
a fractional brain. What's a fractional brain?
A fractional brain? Let's see. So I guess I would define a fractional brain. I don't know if I can just define one fractional brain. I think I have to find, I want to define the whole set at once.
Yeah, we all agree about what fractional brains are in an orbifold somewhere.
Perhaps.
We don't. Okay, but what do you mean by a fractional brain? So, at least a collection of fractional brains? You sound more comfortable with that.
I sound more comfortable, I'm more comfortable with the collection. I mean a collection of objects in this derived category such that if I consider Hom D flat of this object A to itself, this is non-zero. So I get these gauge fields. And if I consider two objects, A not equal to B, so for A not equal to B in this derived category, I want Hom D flat of 0, or in fact 3, by Serre duality to be 0.
That's the definition?
That's what I want. That's the condition I want.
So that's what fractional brain is. Okay.
Should I call them something else?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if X is an orbital singularity, are those the fractional brains?
Yes.
All right. So what's the
fractional brain? So, the definition: we have an exceptional sheaf E has this, and satisfies these two conditions. So there's some non-zero homomorphism from the sheaf to itself, and this is zero for Q greater than zero. That's an exceptional sheaf. So in an exceptional collection, all the sheaves are exceptional. So an exceptional collection, we have some collection of exceptional sheaves, which are ordered. So EI is exceptional. And moreover, XQ from EI to EJ is 0 for I greater than J. So there are only maps going forward in the collection. All the maps going this way vanish. So notice that, I mean, part of the niceness of this is that I'm dealing not with objects in some derived category. I'm just dealing with sheaves. And in all the examples that I usually deal with, these are not even sheaves. They're just line bundles or maybe vector bundles. So this is a much nicer set of objects to work with than these objects in the derived category, even though to those who are just being introduced to it, it may look all rather strange.
So this theorem of yours is a constructive theorem rather than an existence.
It's a constructive.
You said there exists, but it sounds like there's a lot more than that.
Yeah, that's what I would do in the next half hour is I construct this transformation for an example.
If it is toric, it's always line bundles?
That's right. If it's toric, it's always line bundles. Right. And let's see, so I have to define a few more things. So if I have a strongly exceptional collection, then I have one more condition here, which is that XQ EIEJ is 0 for I less than J and Q greater than 0. So the X0, you may know, or I'm telling you now, are homomorphisms. So this essentially means there are only homomorphisms that go forward in this collection. And so if I have a strongly exceptional collection, what I'm really doing is I'm defining some kind of algebra. And if you stay around for another half hour, if I talk that much, or when we meet again, I would show you that that algebra is essentially the quiver algebra for this gauge theory. So that's a strongly exceptional collection. And the last thing I guess I should define, and then we should probably break, is a helix. I hear sighs in the audience. People must really be tired. So a helix is some bi-infinite extension of a collection. So you would define, say, n plus m to be M tensor, the anti-canonical bundle on your manifold, on your Del Pezzo. And then, so you have this infinite guy extending out, so you have EM minus 1, EM, EM plus 1, dot, 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 EN, EM plus N, EM plus N plus 1. And the claim is that if you have a strong helix, then any set of n adjacent elements generates a strong exceptional collection. So this is slightly stronger than just a strong exceptional collection, because in general you could shift this around and you might find something that violates this last condition.
Do you mean m plus e, so m plus 1 is tensor in the canonical? There's, when you do, in the first line, e n plus m.
Yeah.
Do you really mean n?
So I have n.
independence on the right hand side?
I have n elements. Let's see.
Oh, actually, that's the periodicity?
That's the periodicity. So any n adjacent elements of this helix is strongly exceptional, and that's stronger than just this. So if I have that, then I can generate this nice collection of fractional brains. And I think that's a good place to stop. It's 12:20.
Brains on KBR without flux. But you can have a supersymmetric compatibilization of toric on cones, but we have also fluxes, and you preserve supersymmetry. So do you think this can be adapted to the situation?
I guess the way I was thinking about this as some application to flux vacua is you have this collection of brains at a toric singularity, and you're supposed to go through some geometric transition where you replace all those brains with fluxes. And so by looking at these flux vacua, you naturally have some gauge theory interpretation before the transition.
Here you always start from a KBR without flux.
I'm starting something.
It's possible maybe where you have something which is not KBR, but you have a conic solution of the type of 4 times something. So this.
I guess it becomes harder because I get further and further away from this n equals 2 sigma model, which a lot of this stuff grew out of, which insisted you have a Calabi-Yau. Maybe it can be generalized. Sam.
You said that you're not able to actually do this yet for that type of thing. But could you explain maybe what the sticking point, what you're not able to do in this context?
So I guess the way I would address it, after checking the singularity structure of it, which I didn't do yet, so maybe it's too singular to even do, is that, so if you have these polynomials in C4, you can equally well think about them as some polynomial in some weighted projective space. So weighted projective space is like projective space, except all of the coordinates of the homogeneous coordinates have slightly different weights. And here I'm in, I guess, three-dimensional weighted projective space. So I have 4 weights because they're 4 homogeneous polynomials. So the idea would be to think about this polynomial as cutting out some complex 2 surface in this weighted projective space. And then if you're sufficiently strong, you can figure out what some nice collection of line bundles or vector bundles or maybe sheaves look like on this space and work out their maps. And if you're smart and clever about it, you can probably come up with an exceptional collection. And then once you're done with that, probably this prescription will then give you a gauge theory, which is sensible. But I don't know.